This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Thanks for listening to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. This week, the Closing the Gap report came out with some very disappointing results. We talked to NITV journalist Danny Teese-Johnson about how the health, education and employment of Aboriginal Australia compares to the rest of the country. It's Valentine's Day this weekend. We've all heard the saying, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your prince. Well, it turns out this saying might actually be true, with most women settling down with the 13th man they date. Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City says we shouldn't be afraid of dating or of breaking up. Girls are dropping out of sport, and it's partly because of social media. Colette Smart from Family Smart explains the findings of a new study and how we can get girls to stay active. 50 Shades of Grey is at the movies now, so is it just trash or is it more serious than that? Melinda Tancard-Reese from Collective Shout calls on cinema goers to boycott the movie. Deborah Oswald, creator of the hit TV show Offspring, answers all my questions about the series that catapulted Asha Keddie to become a household name and hints that there may yet be another season. She also shares about her new novel, Useful. And in Weekly Perspective, Carl Faes looks at the recent leadership controversy and asks, what makes a good leader? That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Don't forget you can download it from the Hope 103.2 website or subscribe on iTunes. Just search for Hope Media and select the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. My name's Katrina Rowe. Thanks for listening. Well, today our PM described the latest Closing the Gap report as profoundly disappointing. He said, despite the concerted efforts of successive governments, we are not on track to achieve most of the targets. Danny Teese-Johnson is a journalist with NITV News. He's across all the details of this. Hi, Danny.
Good morning, Katrina. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Were you surprised to hear that we're not meeting our targets for Closing the Gap?
No, not at all. I think, you know, Aboriginal Australia sort of expects this sort of each year. So we see that the work that's going on between state and federal governments and the Close of the Gap program itself. And I guess when it comes down to coordination, it certainly hasn't been happening to the best way it can. As a result, we see the gap widening in a lot of areas each year.
Well, it looks at a number of factors, this report, around like health, education, employment. Can we start with health? Are Indigenous people living healthier lives today? Are they living any longer?
It depends where you are. So I think that's one sort of tick they've gotten is a slight increase in the mortality rates and so forth. But in saying that, if you're out in Wilcannia in northwestern New South Wales, the life expectancy for an Aboriginal male out there is 36.7 years, and this is in 2015. So, well, I guess in some other areas there have been some outcomes in mortality rates. Certainly in pocket areas around the country, we're still seeing very low life expectancy rates, particularly for Aboriginal male and Aboriginal women.
That's incredibly shocking, isn't it? I imagine that's worse than many third world countries.
Yeah. It's a very sad indictment, I guess, of what's happening in the Close the Gap program by state and federal governments. And I mean, Bill Shorten had said in Parliament this morning that Burke was a shining example. Now, I've been to Burke, and he said this morning that it's a shining example that we all should look to Burke in northwestern New South Wales as a shining example of the Closing the Gap program. Now, I've been to Burke recently, and you speak to any of the mob out in the street out there, it's a dire situation. So I'm not sure who's advising Bill on this one, but he's got it wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. What about with education? Is there any progress in getting more Aboriginal kids to school and keeping them in school for longer?
Well, we know Nigel Scullion's been, that's certainly something that he's been championing since he's come on board as Indigenous Affairs Minister, but I guess we are seeing a slight increase in school attainment and more kids getting through Year 12, but I think that's sort of centralised to the East Coast areas in the big cities, and that I know certainly speaking in the Northern Territory, that's not happening.
Okay, and what about employment? Because that's the other big factor in kind of, you know, living a healthy, happy life is being able to get a job.
Yeah, and I guess there is a little spike in the increase in employment, but because of the mining boom and the whole Twiggy Forest affair over the last couple of years, there's been a lot more Aboriginal sort of males and females in their early 20s being contracted into mining through various scholarships and programs. So they're becoming fly-in, fly-out. And while the longevity doesn't seem to be there, the statistics are telling us they're not staying in the mining industry very long. They're employed and they're getting some more money. So any little wins that we get in the Close the Gap and the ticks, I think we need to celebrate it.
Okay. So there are some jobs, but just probably in particular industries, like you mentioned mining as one area where there's probably been a bit of jobs growth there.
Yeah, that's about it, I'd say. I mean, you know, everyone has to fly to WA or up to the territory and become a FIFO, and it doesn't work too well.
You mentioned particularly Bourke as being held up as a sort of a shining example. I happen to know that there's still a lot of problems with domestic and family violence in that town. Have there been any improvements in reducing incidents of family violence in Aboriginal homes?
No, that's certainly a gap that's widening, and there's a number of issues around that. I know this isn't sort of an area that's improving. There's a lot of frustration, a lot of poverty, a lot of despair in communities, and unfortunately this is, you know, creating an area where us as Aboriginal males need to improve. But I know there's a lobby group down at Canberra today, Aboriginal Women at the Family Violence Program, and they're lobbying the government to quarantine welfare payments to Aboriginal males who are perpetrators of domestic and family violence.
What do you think of that idea?
I actually don't mind it. Personally, I grew up with domestic and family violence, so I think anything that can do to sort of, I guess, help stem the flow of violence against women and reduce that right down and the impact that it has on the children, I think that would be a good thing. So this has come from Aboriginal women who are saying this, so I think we've earned the respect to listen to them.
So is there any hope, anything positive to come out of this or any way forward that you can see out of this, Danny?
Yeah, I think, like Mick Gooder hit the head, he just had a press conference and he said the governments for 7 years have not listened to the Aboriginal people, the people out on the ground. So the reinstatement of frontline services, the last budget we had $567 million cut out of frontline services. And those services are responsible for closing the gap. But those services non-existent, it's gone. So there's no monitoring, there's no measuring. It's a bit of a headless chicken. But by sort of, you know, centralising it, the Australia's First People Congress may be a good place for that to start, and maybe they can take control on the measuring and the monitoring and the rolling out of the program, because the federal government and state governments don't seem to be working that well together. But if there is a centralisation run by Aboriginal people, then I think we'll see a lot of the areas that we want improved will be improved.
Okay. Thanks for your thoughts this morning, Danny. Appreciate your time.
No worries. Too easy, Katrina. Thank you.
That's Danny Teese-Johnson from NITV News. I'm sure we've all heard the saying that you've got to kiss a lot of frogs before you find your prince. Well, statistics are showing that this is increasingly true. On average, most women will settle down with the 13th man they date. It's a challenging piece of information for Christian women who often have the expectation that they'll marry the first man they go out with. Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net suggests that it might be worth rethinking that expectation. Hi, Jo.
Hi, Katrina.
There was a period, wasn't there, when dating was really out of fashion. Why did dating get such a bad name?
Yeah, certainly for me, like when I was in youth group, the I kissed dating goodbye thing was quite huge.
Okay.
And everyone I knew was kissing dating goodbye, especially the people that had never kissed it hello in the first place.
I mean, I suppose there's some wisdom for that in youth group, you know, when people are 15, 16, 17, not to get too hung up on the whole dating thing. But it's a bit different once you get older, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think, like, totally in youth group and kind of your first 2 years out of school, almost everyone around you is single anyway, and you can actually just hang out together and get to know each other, which is basically the point of dating. But certainly once you get a bit older and most of your friends have started pairing up, it's harder literally just to meet people to get to know, let alone if you're just trying to do that in a totally casual, something will just fall into my lap kind of way.
I hadn't really ever thought about this before, but the people that I know who have met someone and married later in life, you know, meaning sort of, you know, 30s to 40s, amongst my friendship group, it has always happened through deliberate dating. Not, it hasn't just been through, hey, hanging out at church and bumping into each other.
It's not that that doesn't happen anymore at all, but there was a great ad for one internet dating site that used to point out how many people by your age are actually already with someone and how few people there are left for you to get to know. But it's true. The statistics do change. You're not 16 anymore. Not everyone you know is single. And so, yeah, I think thinking about ways that you can consciously pursue friendships at the very least, but heck, why not call it dating? Because there's nothing actually evil about the word. and yeah, think about ways and places that you can meet people and get to know them.
Like you say, most people are coupled up, but also you just don't have as much time. I mean, when you were at school and at uni, there's just a lot of time spent hanging out with people where you can just very naturally and informally get to know one another. But
Absolutely.
Once you get to a certain age, that time becomes so much more compressed and you almost do need to set aside deliberate date time, don't you?
Yeah, totally. And it's funny, I think that's one of the reasons that people who did a lot of dating as teenagers or young adults kind of don't understand what it's like for their older friends. As teenagers or young adults, they got to spend like 20 to 40 hours a week with the person that they were in love with. And it's just not like that when you have a full-time job and a bunch of responsibilities. I think sometimes it's also about understanding that dating just is going to look different when you're older and have a job. And I think this is part of why internet dating, despite its pitfalls, is actually a useful tool as well. It can bring you into contact with some people that you might actually be able to meet and get to know. And stuff like speed dating nights, all of those things have been useful for myself and friends in, actually finding some people who are still single.
And do you think as well there's sort of an element of practicing and learning how to be kind of in an intimate relationship that dating can give you the confidence just to kind of know the way forward a little bit?
Absolutely. I totally got stuck at kind of age 16 in my mind. I'd be embarrassed if a guy opened a door for me. And I kind of needed to get over that a bit, in a sense, to get used to talking to men. And going through that process has been a really beneficial thing. You can learn from it, even if you've had a few dud dates, a few of those awkward set-up blind date moments where your friends have invited both of you over for dinner. Some of these experiences can be a little painful, but you can learn so much about what you want as well and what you're looking for.
The downside of dating is that it inevitably is going to involve breaking up or maybe like a bit of rejection or not the relationship not going forward. Do we need to get better at kind of breaking up nicely so that it doesn't have to mean a string of broken hearts?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why things like statistics about you getting together with the 13th person have actually helped me a lot in realizing it's wonderful to go into a relationship desiring for it to be a permanent thing. And I don't want us to take dating lightly or anything like that. But also, on the other hand, being a bit more relaxed about it and knowing what this is two people getting to know each other. And you might get to a point where you figure out, hey, we don't actually match together that well. That's okay. And that it doesn't have to mean heartbreak. It just means, yep, this is a great person, but we're not particularly suited to each other.
Well, I think the other thing about knowing that for a lot of people it is the 13th means that you don't have to feel like there's anything wrong with you if you have a couple of relationships that don't work out.
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be
something wrong.
Yeah, it's actually normal, so don't worry about it. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks, Joanna. Good to chat again.
Yeah, thanks, Katrina.
That's Joanna Hayes from celibateinthecity.net. A growing number of girls are dropping out of sport in their teenage years. The reason, though, I found a little bit surprising. It's partly because social media is making them self-conscious about their bodies. Colette Smart, adolescent psychologist, joins me in the studio to discuss the findings of this study. Hi, Colette.
Hello. Good morning.
Yeah, now this showed a strong connection between social media and poor body image. Can you explain what the link is?
Yeah, so what they found was when girls spend a lot of time on social media, they tend to be analysing other people's bodies or particularly following sites which we call FITSPO sites.
Ooh,
now, FITSPO is actually they're supposed to be fitness inspiration sites.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, though, what the study found and said, which I completely agree with, is a lot of these sites focus on skinniness and people with perfect six packs and diets, which we know inevitably don't work. And so they actually create a negative effect rather than a positive body effect.
Well, that's interesting because I've never come across this before. I don't have FITSPO in my life, but is it quite popular amongst the teens?
Yes, yep. FITSPO sites and with women in general.
Yeah.
I just want to say here that I think we need to also be careful that we don't simplistically say Facebook or Instagram causes teen depression or causes teen poor body image and so on. Mm. It's very multifaceted,
okay.
Obviously. So there's all sorts of facets. And social media will be one of the aspects that could create this issue.
It's interesting that they did find a link, though, between that and actually kids not just feeling bad about their bodies, but actually dropping out of sport.
Yeah. So I think we've become very good for many years now teaching media literacy and talking to girls and young people about how corporates, you know, are selling products rather than actually selling the truth.
Yeah.
And so girls are becoming better and better at recognizing that or finding that out. But I think we haven't got to the point yet where we tell them enough that social media sites and even their friend sites.
And then selfies that their mates are doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Social media often has very little to do with being authentic, I think.
Yeah.
It's creating a persona or creating an image people want to put forward. So you only put your best self forward.
Yeah.
And so getting girls to recognize that is quite important.
Okay. And it was interesting. There were other factors, weren't there, that influenced young girls and whether they got involved in physical activity. It wasn't just the
Yes, absolutely. So things like wanting to study, recognizing possibly after year 10 was the time the dropouts began to happen. After year 10, you knew your HSC was looming. Yet we've got to be encouraging girls to continue with sport and physical exercise. It's so good for their brain and okay. body development. And I think...
So what are some ways then that we can address this and kind of keep girls active? Particularly it seems like from that year 10 onwards. I know for me it was kind of around year 12 I stopped playing
yes.
sport because of study.
Yeah.
And then I picked up later. But yeah, well, how can we keep girls being physically active in those crucial teenage years?
Well, I think encouraging them not to drop out as parents, not to say, yeah, your studies are so important, because we do think they are, but realizing that when girls are involved in exercise, it actually enhances their mood. You get endorphins from that. It also enhances their study ability because you've got more oxygen to your brain. I think as parents also talking about what's happening on social media, talking about the sites they follow. Some sites that I absolutely love that I personally follow are my favorites, Choose Nutrition. So Meg McClintock is a nutritionist and okay. she's a body positive, health at every size nutritionist. I love her work. Then sites like Beauty Redefined, Body Matters Australasia. And these are psychologists and nutritionists who believe in health-giving messages rather than skinniness or thinness. So girls will actually get positive messages about food and their body. And then for mums, I always say to mums when I do seminars, please stop the fat talk in your home. Not the, does my bum look big in these jeans? Girls then start to think, well, there must be a certain size bum that should be in jeans. What's wrong with mine? And so the way you talk about yourself as an adult affects your daughter massively.
Mm.
So being aware of how you talk about food. Food is not morally good or bad. In our home, we talk about food that is sometimes food or occasional foods, and then foods that are good for your brain and your body development. Not, oh, you know, I feel bad today because I had chocolate cake. I can't stand that.
No. The thing is, though, I find too that they're so influenced by their peers. So I find even though in our house I try not to use that negative talk or anything, they're still picking it up everywhere at school.
Yeah, they do, but be encouraged because a lot of the studies show that their biggest influencing factors do come from the home.
Uh-huh.
So they're what their parents say about food, about exercise, exercising for enjoyment rather than punishing your body for eating something.
Yeah.
That's what they internalize those messages a lot more and they're better equipped to deal with the pressures from social media and their friends at school.
Yeah, well, that's great. So as always, it is about being involved and actively involved in all these kind of issues. Thanks, Colette. Some great tips there.
Thank you.
That's Colette Smart from Family Smart. We were talking about why girls are dropping out of sport and just some simple ways we can get some more positive influence back into their lives. Well, what could arguably be the world's trashiest novel is being released today as a feature film, 50 Shades of Grey, and it's being plugged and promoted in terms of a Valentine's Day release. I guess the question to ask is it just trashy or is it more sinister than that? Melinda Tankard-Reist from Collective Shout is on the line. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Katrina.
What are your concerns with 50 Shades of Grey?
Well, we don't believe that sadistic abuse should be presented as romance. We have an epidemic of domestic violence, women suffering violence at the hands of men. This film packages all that up as romance, as in fact a love story. Christian Grey is controlling, he's manipulative, he's emotionally and physically violent. He demands that Anastasia sign a contract agreeing to do what he wants. These are things that we normally condemn. We normally urge women to avoid men that do that. But the hype around 50 Shades of Grey suggests that domestic violence is sexy, that if he stalks her, this is a sign of true love.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I was just thinking, I'm speaking to Rosie Batty on Monday. Yesterday we had the Closing the Gap report, and one of the issues in that was family and domestic violence. Yeah. It feels like a big setback, doesn't it, when something like this comes along?
It really does, and this is just so often the case, that the causes we care about and advocate on get romanticised in media and popular culture and in film. I mean, this film sends a strong message that if you love a sadistic abuser, he'll change and you'll live happily ever after in a really big house with nice children. You know, what a myth.
Yeah.
So it encourages women to stay on longer than they should have, thinking, well, I can change him. You know, he really does love me and I can and change him. And, you know, these are the kind of women that end up in domestic violence shelters. These are the kind of women that end up in, you know, battered shelters for abused victims and children. And this is why domestic violence groups globally have combined to condemn the film, and they've started a campaign called $50 Not 50 Shades, calling for a boycott of the film and asking for donations to women's shelters instead, because they've seen too many real life Anastasias. You know, these are the kind of women that turn up in their shelters. And so that's why we're helping to support that campaign, $50 Not 50 Shades.
Okay, so it's really just in terms of action and what you want people to do, it's really just saying don't see the movie and instead support something positive that's actually helping women.
Boycott the film and support women's refuges, which, you know, in Australia the funding has been gutted at federal and state level. And so these helping services need all the help that they can get.
I don't really understand why women would want to see this movie, but they must. I mean, it's women reading the book, and I assume that the film is targeted at women as well.
Of course. This is one of the very disturbing things that, you know, the marketing around 50 Shades has been so successful that bondage and torture, abuse, stalking are presented as romantic, and we don't need more myths about intimate partner violence being a reflection of true love. We don't need a romanticisation of domestic abuse. So, yes, we are urging women to boycott the film, to not get sucked in by the spin, and to send some money to shelters.
All right. Where can people find out more about this?
They can find out more about it on Collective Shout's website. That's collectiveshout.org, on Collective Shout's Facebook, and on my Facebook as well, Melinda Tankard-Reese. And we've got some new information going up about it today.
Okay. Now, also, while I've got you, Melinda, you're about to embark on a very exciting challenge, aren't you? Can you tell us about that?
Well, exciting or an act of madness. I'm part of a team called Tribe 2020, which is taking part in the Sydney Coast Trek, which is an endurance feat of 55 kilometres in a day to raise support for the Fred Hollows Foundation. Because what's not well known is that 4 out of 5 people who are blind in developing countries aren't needlessly blind, and it only takes $25 to cure that blindness so the blind can see again. And my team is all interested in physical fitness and challenges. The only problem for me is that my other teammates are half my age, so they won't be carrying me across the finish line. But 55 kilometres in between 12 and 18 hours. And so we're looking for sponsorship. As I said, $25 stores site.
Yeah,
which is quite amazing, isn't it? And so people can find out about that on my website as well, melindatankardreese.com.
Okay. Well, thanks, Melinda. All the best with that. It's coming up very quickly, isn't it? Another week or two?
It's coming up very, very quickly. You're right about that. It's on March the 6th in Sydney. We're doing the beach trek, which is from Palm Beach to Balmoral.
And you have to phone in and let us know how you go.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Melinda, take hard rest. You can find out more about the 50 Shades of Grey campaign at collectiveshout.org or at their Facebook page. And you can check out more about Sydney Coast Trek too at Melinda Tankard Rees' blog. Just Google her name. Thanks, Melinda.
A pleasure, Katrina. Thanks for having me on the show. Open your hips to me. Open your hips.
Well, for lovers of the TV show Offspring, Nina Proudman, her sister Billy, and the rest of her family were like old friends. And now that they're not around anymore, I don't know about you, but I have a genuine sense of loss. Deborah Oswald is the co-creator of the hit series Offspring, and she has just released a brand new novel, Useful. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
Are you missing Nina and all her friends?
Look, I am, because they've lived in my head. They lived in my head, they had been living in my head for 6 years. Well, longer ago, really.
Yeah.
The idea came to me years before we actually got the show up. But, you know, you get to know them and you love them like they're your family and friends, and I've been tormenting them and making them happy and doing horrible things to them for a long time.
It's such a big hit, that show. I mean, how was the idea conceived? Where did it come from?
Look, it came from the fact that I felt that there was a lot of television, this is 8 or 9 years ago now, there was a lot of television that was about bodies on autopsy slabs. There was a lot of murder mysteries. There's nothing wrong with that. That's all marvellous. But I just felt there was a part of life that I wasn't seeing on the screen. So I thought, what's the opposite of death? Is birth. So an obstetrician seemed like a good idea. And I really wanted to do a show about a big, boisterous family.
Yeah.
So I just kind of threw an obstetrician into the middle of a big boisterous family and out came Offspring.
And the character of Nina, I think, made Asha Keddy a household name. Was she on your radar from the beginning, or how did she get that role?
By the time we were commissioned to make a telly movie and I sat down to write that telly movie script, we knew we were writing it for Asha.
Mm.
And for Cat Stewart too. From a writer's point of view, that's a great luxury. First of all, just knowing you've got two such wonderful actors, but also knowing the specific person you're writing for, you can be more precise and you can write around their strengths. Mm. I mean, Ash is such an amazing, has such an amazing ability to flip from really sharp comedy to tear your heart out, emotional stuff, that I could use that. You know, I knew I could ask that of her and she could do it.
Well, obviously Asha Keddy is a big part of the success and I guess the connection people had with Nina, but from a more writer's point of view, why was Nina so much of a hit? Why do people love her character so much?
I don't know. I mean, if we all had the answer to that, we'd all be out there, you know, repeating it again and again. Look, my best guess is that because she was a person who was a competent adult in the world, in that she, you know, she was a successful doctor and she was running her life perfectly well and she was the helper fixer in her own family. But at the same time, she was racked with self-doubt. I think that combination speaks to a lot of people out there. A lot of us feel like that there's this strange disconnect between how competent we seem in the world and how befuddled we are inside our own minds.
They're almost like waiting to be discovered as a fraud. That sort of complex.
Absolutely. People often say that, and I think that's part of it. And that process that you go in to have an encounter with someone and you're rehearsing in your mind how it will go, or after you leave a scene, you berate yourself for all the ways you mucked it up. I think that process is true for almost everyone I know. So I just tried to find a way to show that on screen.
I think a lot of us, when we'd hear Nina's internal monologues, would think, who wrote this and how did they get inside my head?
That's good to know.
You also now, of course, have become known as the woman who killed Patrick. How do you live with yourself?
Look, I know. That will be on my gravestone, I think. Well, you know, the only consolation I can offer is that we, that is the writing team, suffered a lot in the process. We wept. We felt very bad about doing it. We felt very sad for him and for Nina and for the baby and for everybody. But then again, I think it made for great story. I think the end of season four and season five were richer and deeper and more interesting because that had happened.
I'm getting sad now. I'm sorry. And of course, it was also then this sadness that the whole thing was coming to an end and there wouldn't be another season. Can you explain to us what brought Offspring to an end?
Well, I'm not in a position to say there won't be another season.
Still possible.
I just can't say.
Okay. Oh, well, there's hope. Yeah, you heard it first here on Hope 103.2.
Meanwhile, people can just watch the box set.
Absolutely. I've got two. I ended up with two versions of the box set. So, you know, if anyone doesn't have
one of them gets tired, you can play the other one.
That's right. I'm speaking to Deborah Oswald. She's a playwright, an author and a scriptwriter, the co-creator of TV's Offspring. Her new novel, Useful, is out now. Now, Deborah, this has a very interesting premise. I might get you to explain to us about Sullivan Moss and the predicament that he finds himself in.
Well, Sullivan Moss is a sort of a likeable no-hoper who decides that the only way he can be useful in the world is to donate his kidney to a stranger. So the book then follows the process that a person has to go through to pass all the tests, not so much medical tests, but to be fit enough and psychologically healthy enough to be considered a donor. Even though he starts from this very low, tragic point, it's really a story about a man transforming his life accidentally.
I'm not finished the book yet, but, you know, I'm looking at this hopeless kind of loser character in Sullivan, and you want him to come good, but you're just not sure that he can, you know, that he seems a bit too far gone. Is there any hope for him?
I kind of set myself quite a difficult game. I pushed him into such a bad position that to make him transform himself is fairly hard work. Mind you, he is a smart man. He is fundamentally healthy. He is a good-hearted person. I think there's no question about that he's a kind of decent, kind person, but who keeps sabotaging himself and other people through his thoughtlessness and through booze and kind of immaturity, really. So the story is about him growing up.
Yeah, I just found it interesting that you decided to base a novel around a character who is pretty much a loser. What was it about that sort of appealed to you?
I was just so interested in drilling right down to ask questions about what makes a person valuable. So I tried to make, seems to me that you can look at that question at its most fundamental level if the person doesn't have any other surface reason that the world would value them. You know, they're not successful or wealthy or apparently talented, or they don't have children. They don't seem to have any of the goodies that we use when we decide that somebody is a valuable person. The only thing he's got to trade are his organs. But I do think that you know, every human being is precious and without measurement. And the book is really about how that might work.
That's interesting. All right, well, you've done a lot, Deborah. Obviously, we can't talk about your whole career, but, you know, you've done TV series, you've done novels, you've done kids' books, you've written plays. What's next? What are you working on?
I'm very old. I've been around a long time, so I've written a lot of things. at the moment, I just love the chance to write both fiction and TV drama. I think they're the two forms in the world at the moment that are exciting me. You know, like, I love reading and I love watching good television. So if I can go on writing those two shaped things...
Is there another novel that's already completed that we're going to see?
No, not completed, okay. Sadly. There's other novels brewing in my head, and there's other television projects that I'm planning to send out to the world. Well, send to producers and hope that they will make them for the world.
Well, that's exciting. So we might hear from you again in another year or two about what's happening next.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
No worries. Thank you.
That's Deborah Oswald, creative Offspring, and now the author of this new novel. It's called Useful. Well, each week we catch up with Christian media commentator Carl Faes, where we look back on a big issue from the week and try to understand its implications from a Christian perspective. Yesterday, the news emerged that a US think tank has published a paper asking whether Tony Abbott might be the most incompetent leader of any industrialized democracy. Now, the ongoing discussion about Tony Abbott's leadership raises, I think, a more important question, and that is, what makes a good leader and what can we realistically expect of them? Carl Faes has been giving this some thought on our behalf. Hi, Carl.
Boy, it's tough when the think tank starts asking about how incompetent you are as a leader, isn't it?
I know. I just thought that's a blow.
Sure,
it's not a good look. But look, after the leadership spiel, Tony Abbott promised to change his leadership style to be more consultative. Is that necessarily what makes a better leader? You know, is one style of leadership more effective than another?
Oh, it's a really good question, because leadership is such a dynamic relationship, and whether it's in the church, in a community group, or in politics, there's two kind of semi-jokes about leadership. The leader's without a follower is just a man going for a walk. The other is, Peter, I heard Peter Costello say this. He said, look, there go all the people over there. I must run after them because I'm their leader.
Now,
interestingly, there's a kind of relationship between that, because politics feels a little bit like the statement which Peter Costello was using, the whole idea, well, I check where all the people are going and I run over there and pretend to be their leader. That's
a great image, isn't it? It really is.
But the trouble is, that's not actually leadership. But there is a... You can't have leadership without consultancy. You can't have leadership without listening. And you can't have leadership without people being on side. But in some ways, but you still got to try and lead. So there's this dynamic relationship going on. But I actually think one of the big issues about leadership, and this is the problem in politics, and it was the problem for Julia Gillard, and it is the problem for Tony Abbott, and that's trust.
Mm.
You know, the one thing that if anybody that leads knows, that basically people give you trust, and they go, okay, I'm not sure about this, but I think you know, and so I'm trusting you, and let's head down that path together.
And I guess that consultation is part of the trust building process, that people feel listened to and that they understand the reasons for the decision, and that sort of communication process is part of building trust, isn't it?
It is, and if you're clear about where you're going and you're clear about what you're trying to achieve, not everyone will agree, and certainly in politics, you just need 51% to agree in the right places. But the problem is when the message is muddy, when they can't trust what you're saying, when they're not sure of the future, they withdraw their consent for you to lead, and that's where you get in a lot of trouble from the whole leadership process.
So are there particular qualities, though? I mean, obviously you mentioned trust, but are there other qualities that make a good leader?
There's this whole sense of people being willing to follow where you're going, and so there's again that dynamic relationship between people warming to you personally because they kind of like you, which again the polls tell us that Tony's sort of struggling with that a little bit. Tony Abbott's struggling with that a bit, but on the other hand, there's that whole idea of clarity of thought and the ability to pitch a vision. So communication in leadership is really important, and it's not just there's communication one-on-one, and there's because you need to do that with your colleagues, and there's communication on a kind of broader level as well. And that kind of almost likability part of who you are. There are certain people, like whether you liked or hated Bob Hawke, there was this sense of likability about Bob Hawke. Australians just kind of liked him.
Yeah.
And so there was that sense of kind of moving forward and being willing to follow where he was going, even though you wondered about him. And that, I think in Australia as well, there's that, this is very Australian culture, there's that sort of down-to-earth nature. Again, if you go back to Bob Hawke, I think that Tony Abbott has it as well. That sort of down-to-earth, bloke next-door nature. I think that's why people in New South Wales really warm to Mike Baird as well. He has that sort of sense that he is the bloke next door.
Yeah, you could hang out with him, yeah.
Yeah, but a very competent bloke.
That's cool. And is there a uniquely sort of Christian approach to leadership? Did Jesus say or show us much about this issue?
Oh, look, I think the thing with Jesus is he actually changed leadership radically. I mean, if you went back to Greco-Roman times with the aristocracy, They ran it and they ruled it and they were born to rule and that was it. Mm. And everybody else just followed in line. Whereas Jesus came and said things like, he didn't come to be served but to serve and to actually give his life for other people. And the whole idea that first will be last and the last will be first, which is another quote of his. And Paul talks about Jesus. He wrote to some friends in a place called Philippi. He writes a letter and he quotes a kind of, sort of like a hymn poem about Jesus, which says that Jesus didn't, even though he's equal with God, didn't grasp equality with God, but made himself nothing, gave himself to other people. Here is this model of leadership, which now the world has actually grasped, this idea of humility in leadership, this idea of servant leadership, the idea of putting other people and serving and putting them first, and not grasping after power, but grasping, actually giving yourself to other people. That changed how we see leadership.
Yeah, and if we saw more of that in politics, I don't think we'd have any trouble with them keeping their spots. So
I think so, because there's always complaints about how much they get paid and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, is all about the fact that the fear that they're really after themselves, not what's best for us.
Yeah.
And it ought to be the second.
That's right. Well, thank you, Carl. Good to have some thoughts from you on that.
Pleasure.
That's Carl Faze with our weekly perspective. We've been talking about what makes a good leader.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.